Hey, Vlado. Thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Hi, Shane.
So I'm looking forward to our conversation today. You have written a number of pieces and a book on, fundamentalism and conspiracy theories and how this relates to, or, looked through a Jungian perspective. And you yourself are a Jungian analyst and a psychotherapist, and this is very much part of your world. And it's very interesting because in the times today, there's so many conspiracy theories and fundamentalist ideas out there. And I think understanding where these come from and why people are perhaps so attracted to them is really important because it can help us get a sense of exactly what's going on, right? What's the psychology behind all of this? And it's a great book and I recommend it. And so that's what we're going to be talking about today. So maybe let's get a little lay of the land first. And conspiracy theory as such is quite a broad term, right? It could encompass many things like false beliefs or just bad information. But really, I think that we're going to be talking about like a very kind of specific conspiratorial thinking, right? So how do you understand conspiracy theory or conspiracism?
So, conspiracism is a relatively new term. I think we can find it maybe goes back to 80s and 90s. But I prefer talking about dark religion, which
Okay.
is a broader term that can really encompass a way one understands reality, and if that reality is distorted or if it's if something is not true and one adheres to it in sort of a fanatic way, then it becomes a conspiracy theory. I mean, you can think of a conspiracy theory being during the Spanish Inquisition, right? And when people are looking at the woman as being witches, and they had all kinds of special abilities and all kinds of things they were accused of. And the Holy Church were actually willing to go as far as, burning them, torturing them, and trying to actually admit that what they were accused of, that is true, right? So we can look at the conspiracy theory as a false or distorted belief about reality. You can think of communism, for example, as an idea of paradise that is being projected onto real world. People say, well, it's possible we're going to have this perfect perfect world,
Utopia.
yeah, utopia on Earth.
Yeah, it's interesting. So why do you call it dark religion?
So the darkness is the dark is a symbol itself, right? Like, what is dark? Dark is everything that we don't have enough light on. So dark means unconscious. Dark means not seen really well. Dark means not being able to be processed by consciousness. So dark is that which is behind. We also use a term of being eclipsed, that ego is being eclipsed, or we can talk about theocalypsis, which is hiding behind God or hiding behind some kind of energy and pretending this is true, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so the darkness is like hidden rather than dark symbolizing evil as such. I mean, it can, but in this particular instance, we're talking about the hidden nature of it and, hiding behind the idea or something like that. And so my question is perhaps like, when people are engaged in a conspiratorial theory or a cult or whatever it is, do you think that they're consciously hiding behind these theories, or do you think it's a lot more unconscious and that they're just experiencing their being part of this group and like this is the truth and we know the answers and the sort of self entitled, not self entitled, but that sort of like self confidence in like we know the answers, like this is the truth, right?
Well, I think this is a very difficult question to answer. I think it's on. I think there is a certain spectrum of it. There are people who really buy into it, and they really are persuaded that's what they believe is true, and they they don't have any other way to verify that they're sort of buying to it fully. So they are fully unconscious of their effect of the conspiracy theory, for example. Mm-hmm. But there are people who have a sort of secondary gain, and they are aware of that, what they're doing, and they're sort of self-deluding themselves. They want to believe it. Alex Jones comes to mind, right? In private, he's talking about it, how they're going to, you know, make this up. And then in public, he's stating, you know, all these conspiracy theories. And now when you talk to him, he's kind of on the edge. He's not a very self-aware person. He's like living in, he's not really sure, I think, if what's true and what's not true. And it's rather more fluid or Donald Trump. And people say, well, of course he knows the elections were not stolen, right? Like he knows the truth people are telling him. So he has moments when he believes it, but then it probably does, his ego doesn't allow him to fully embrace it. So he goes back and forth, and then he, at some moments he may believe that in reality. So, but most of the followers, I would say, most of the people who spread conspiracy theories who don't have like a financial gain or the power gain from it, they probably are very unaware that it's fake.
Yeah, because I would imagine it's difficult, if not impossible, to intentionally believe something you know to be false, right? And I'm not sure if you, what do you think about the idea that you can make yourself believe something?
Actually, I think it's possible. You know, it's a form of hypnosis. There is a lot of techniques that actually are used in persuading and manipulating people. I mean, Goebbels is one example. He says when you repeat a lie 1,000 times, it becomes the truth, mm-hmm. right? I mean, during the dark times in Germany, during Third Reich, many people were probably scratching their heads, but it was become repeated, and they sort of started to believe it, and they became persuaded of something that they would not originally believe that. And I think people can do it to themselves. As a mm-hmm. psychotherapist, I see how, for example, some people are in very toxic relationships, even abusive relationships, and they're looking for reasons to believe it's actually a good relationship. The partner loves them, and look at these examples of how he or she loves them because they brought the gifts and et cetera. And they have a tendency to forget or split off or pushed away, which I should say, split off is a little different process, but suppressing the truth and not mm-hmm. wanting to look at the truth and being actually willingly looking away. And once you start looking away for long enough, then you actually identify with the part of yourself that wants to believe that.
Yeah, so that's sort of like level of self-delusion. Right, that happens. And I suppose perhaps we all do it to some degree in our rationalization of things, of our behaviors, particularly the not such healthy ones where, you know, we have this internal conflict of like, I know it's not good, but also like it's fine. So I'm going to look for more reasons to do it because that's what I want to do. Even mm-hmm. though I some part of me knows that it's not good, you sort of ignore that or push it away or suppress it. And I guess if you do that long enough and you practice whatever this behavior or thinking pattern is enough times, then it becomes stronger and stronger and more likely for you to really just accept it as fact and reality for yourself and potentially for all of the world, right?
I agree. I mean, Charles Darwin was, he actually said that he had a very strong tendency to forget counter arguments to his theory. When he was developing theory of evolution, he actually said, well, you know, it's so easy to forget and just kind of like focus on what my belief is, what my theory is starting to portray. So he was a very disciplined and conscious and responsible person. So he was writing it down and he came back to those and he actually struggled consciously with that because there is always an unpleasant process to learn the truth. Mm-hmm. Right? Learn the truth about something that you believe for a long time. And then you look at the numbers and you start to realize, wow, so I was wrong. I actually made a fool of myself, right? And then you have all kinds of feelings of shame, and you have this feeling like, oh, how am I going to admit it to other people? That doesn't feel good, right? Like it all goes down to the feelings. And it's so much easier to say, well, you know, I'm not going to deal with this feeling. I'm just going to keep buying into this original theory.
Yeah. Especially if you've been doing it for a long time and externally been involved in various groups or activities or relationships where that's sort of featured centrally. And then all of a sudden, you know, you realize that it's been based on a non-truth, right? A falsehood. I hesitate to say lie because that sort of insinuates that it's, you know, malicious, but perhaps it's just you misbelieved something to be true when in fact it wasn't. And yeah, I mean, I think perhaps everyone's gone through this at some point where you have to face the reality. You know, the world sort of presents something to you in such a way that you can no longer deny the real truth, and you have to confront this part of yourself that believed that it wasn't true. And you're right, it's a very painful transformative process because you're faced to now be responsible for the consequences of what's led up to this. And I think that's okay, right? I mean, that's part of human growth and evolution, right? It's part of our differentiation process of just, you have to get rid of what's not working and replace new, you know, old beliefs with new beliefs. And it's a hard process.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's an evolution. It's an evolution of consciousness, right? We get to the point that we are confronted with something that is real, and that itself is the religious process, right? The getting to know the reality itself and living the lives that have meaning and use this one life we have, if you are not Buddhist or believe in reincarnation, to the best of its capacity.
Yeah.
And hopefully we strive for it. And I believe there is an instinct. Jung certainly believed there was a religious instinct that is compelling us to do that.
Could you speak a bit more about the religious instinct?
Well, so that kind of goes to a deeper things that we talk about in our book, The Dark Religion, that George Didier and me wrote. And it's really an instinct towards individuation. Is an instinct to search and seek wholeness, as Jung would put it. It's the instinct to become conscious, to explore, but not only to explore the world, but to be united with the self. So we can kind of imagine this, you know, we're born as whole, but on an unconscious level, right? Like we are connected with the collective unconscious, but we are not conscious of it. And then consciousness is emerging from it, but there is so much unconscious out there that is just being simply projected into the world. So we don't see the world as incarnated. We see it as a very magical, dreamlike universe, right? And as we hopefully become conscious and explore it, we withdraw those projections and we become, on one hand, self-aware, but we also are aware of the world, of its contradictions, of its painful aspects, and especially the painful aspect of the world, the question of mortality, suffering, you know, all these diseases and, you know, injustice and so on, all these big Buddhist questions, or Christian, or, you know, every religion dealing with those questions of darkness in terms of pain of the world. So we have to come to terms with that. And how do we come to terms with that? It's bind to religion, and there's religion instincts, finding a way of accepting contradictions or paradoxes of life and become okay with that and find the best way of existing with those contradictions.
Right. So it's about, for me, I sort of understand it fundamentally as like an instinct to make sense of the world, right? In terms of like, there's, as you say, the world to, you know, a non-reflective eye, let's say, is very chaotic and magical and mystical in the sense of like, who knows why things happen, right? And even if you sort of have a reductionistic sort of perspective of like, oh, well, everything has a cause and you can keep tracing these causes back all the way. Even then, it's like, there's still that sense of, you know, where is this first cause and why? Perhaps is a deeper question, at least from my perspective, of like, even if you could explain how, that doesn't explain why, right? Now, maybe it's the wrong question to ask, but it's a very human question to look for meaning and a sense of reason, right? I mean, perhaps that's why, it's because of our sort of reasoning faculties that we want to understand the explanation. Well, we want an explanation of why things happen. And on a more day-to-day basis, it sort of manifests as, why is there suffering? Why do bad things happen to good people? You know, why do children get cancer and, you know, get sold into slavery rings and all these really terrible and tragic things that happen? And it's hard to not have an answer to that, right? And I think that many hundreds of, not even many, 100+ years ago, right, before the age of information and science being where it is today, like, you really couldn't go very far for answers, right? You look to your elders of various traditions and religions and things like that for answers, and they just looked to their superiors and predecessors of previous generations, right? And for the longest time, it's always been attributed to some version of a deity or deities, right? Some gods, because that filled the, at least in part, what the sort of God idea filled was the reason behind things and where all of these mysterious events are coming from. I mean, it's, you know, it's different in our modern world where we live in houses with like controlled climates and, you know, nature is very rarely a threat to us. But when something truly devastating happens, like a natural disaster, and you realize the sheer power of so-called nature, right? You're like, it's really a humbling experience because you realize how little control you actually have of things as much as you try. Never mind the fact that as hard as you try, you're going to die, right? Like, that's the existential question that also ponders people. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. Yeah. I mean, there is a lot of things to unpack in your, you know, in your statement, but I agree with you. It's so when you look at why, right? I mean, there are many, at least three whys that we can look at, like why, where is it coming from? Why I feel a certain way, or, you know, there is some reason, some primal cause in the past. But there is also why, to what purpose it is happening, why there is something rather than nothing, right? Like, why there is universe, why we are here, why, you know, can we just answer just because or nobody knows? I mean, our mind are seeking to answer those questions. And there is also why, what is happening in the present moment to give us this ability to live in a moment, the certain emotions, certain feelings, certain ideas that are actually emerging in here and now, hits and notes. So I guess we will never fully know, and we are here to explore and to ask those questions.
And
the big three Kantian questions, is there afterlife? Is there a free will, and is there a God?
Yeah.
I mean, these are a reason only hits the antimonies of the pure reason. We can never know the answers to those. But we seek, and there is something in ourselves that is relating to the mystery of life. And that mystery, I guess it's connected with religious instinct. And
Did Jung believe in a, like, why there is a universe rather than not? Did he ever speak about that or write about that?
You know, I don't know actually. I don't know specifically if he ever answered this question, but I know he had all kinds of experiences that were amazing. That you know, he had this after death experience, and he was sort of ascending, and then he saw the light, and then he actually decided to go back, and then he, when he had a heart attack, and then he sort of woke up from it, and he saw his doctor. He was told that his doctor was actually that he died, and he met this doctor who said he was going to follow their light, and he would see spirits, and he would be in a places that he would see the battle somewhere in a, I think it was in France or Switzerland, somewhere on the border, that he would hear and see people fighting, and there was a great fight that happened 100 years prior, but there was a lot of bloodshed. So he had a lot of spiritual experiences. He had this special gift, and that's why he is such a gift to us.
Yeah,
that he pondered on those questions, but I don't know if he answered the question why that is.
Yeah.
He said this world is here to be experienced consciously. When he was in Africa, he said he saw hundreds, herds of animals, and this immense, unbelievable beauty that you've probably seen in your life, right?
Yeah. It is beautiful. It's honestly magical to be out in the wild with animals. It's a very cool experience.
Yeah, I can't. I never been to Africa. Wish I did go. Hopefully one day.
One day.
And he saw it and he said, "This is so profoundly beautiful. It is a purpose to the consciousness, to existence, to be witness of it. Like you, the consciousness is something that without consciousness, there would not, this beauty would not exist, right? It would not be reflected somewhere." So he said, "God must have created the world, but he also wanted to become conscious, and he became conscious through the human being so he can ponder and witness all of it. But it came with all kinds of other consequences, as you know, having the dark side, which is unconscious."
Yeah. And you know, it's about the sort of that balance of like, whenever there has to be good and bad at the same time, right? So to have this high level of consciousness, we also have to deal with the ramifications of that on the dark side of things. And you know, it's like you don't appreciate something except in its absence, perhaps, or because of its absence. Maybe you can appreciate it after having lost it for a short time. And I really do believe that to be true, right? And it's this idea of, I don't know what Jung's Latin word is, the joining of opposites, right?
Conjunctio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, conjunctio oppositorium or whatever. I wish I knew proper terminology one day. And it's fascinating, but I actually want to ask you about, you know, Jung's spiritual experiences and how he conceived of spirituality. You know, what exactly like did that mean to him? And also, what does it mean to you, you know, being a Jungian scholar and an analyst?
Mm-hmm. So if you don't mind, before I answer that, I just want to go back to what you said. The appreciating the other side, because it's connected to what is with spirituality. So what spirituality, so it's not only appreciating it, it's actually being able to comprehend it, to actually be able to exist with that. Like, how would we know the light without the darkness? How would we know the good without the evil? Right? That's what the Leibniz said, that the theodicy, it's like really based on of the God's idea of creating world, which is the best out of all possible worlds, because we had so many options. Yeah. You cannot create the world that is only good or only bad. It has to be, in order to be perfect, it has to have both sides. So now going back to the question of the spirituality. So Jung thought of it as when he spoke of spirituality, he spoke about religion, In terms of religio, reconnecting, like there is something that is to be connected with something that was either lost or stolen, and so on. So it's basically, if I put it simply, how I understand Jung, it's a spiritual process of connecting of ego or the conscious aspect of ourselves with the unconscious, with all that that is unknown to us, mysterious, and so on, and having an appreciation to it, having an awe while looking at it and making sense of it, that eventually becomes part of our own morality, and in terms of religious morality, meaning taking responsibility for our actions, existing with the knowledge of what can we cause to the world, being conscious of of what we are doing to the world, and to with everything that comes with that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that that ties in with the religious instinct, right? Of like, this is a part of being human. Don't you think?
I agree with you. So if you think about it, it's a kind of a simple example that helps me think about it. Once you become conscious and you see, you don't want to go back and become unconscious. Let's say I use the, for example, a Ted Cruz, right? Like he's spreading those lies about there is no global warming, and you know he's lying because we know that he's, you know, intelligent enough to know the truth about global warming, for example, when we look at this particular topic. But he's spreading it because he has a political gain, financial gain, power gain, and so on. But if he were to reach the consciousness and he would see what his action is actually creating in the world, maybe he would have an ayahuasca experience or went through Jungian analysis, what reason would he have to go back and say, you know what, I have seen, I had this experience of extended consciousness. Now I know in my heart the connection between the world and my own infinitesimal human being. Why would I go back? What are the arguments that he can make to say, you know, I'm going to go back to be unconscious and being this bliss of ignorance just because I have money? Because money, power, or anything else doesn't mean anything once you have kind of connected with the deeper knowledge of your own existence.
And would you say that that connection is what in the East has been sort of coined enlightenment?
Enlightenment? I'm sorry, say it again.
Yeah, enlightenment.
Okay, yeah.
Is that what you would consider, like in the East, they call it enlightenment, like the Buddhists attain enlightenment or whatever. And in our sort of Western traditions, it's more thinking about that connection to the universe as a whole. It's just we use different terminology.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there will be a lot of experts who would kind of say that I'm kind of new agey and I'm trying to make parallels between, I don't know, the mysticism, the Christian mysticism, or other religions, and the Eastern philosophy, and so on. I mean, I am a layman from that perspective, but to my, how I understand it, my wife is Buddhist, and, you know, I just came from Vietnam. We were practicing some Buddhist rituals there, spoke to monks. So it kind of looks, it's all points to the one thing. It all points to the one direction. If there is something like reality, there are hopefully more ways to discover it. And I think enlightenment from the Eastern tradition, really realizing there is no ego, there is no self, right? All is one.
And that's the highest level of it too.
Yeah, it's a matter of experience, right? You can't describe it. So how do you explain it? Well, it's just an experience. And once you experience it, then you know. Just like once you have a green tea or coffee, then you know how it tastes like, but you can't explain it to somebody who never had it.
Yeah, and you know, in those traditions, as in all sort of religious or spiritual traditions, they all talk about the same thing of like, it's not something that you can know through knowledge, right? You know it through experience. And they try and point you towards experiencing it for yourself so that you know with your heart is one way of putting it, instead of with your brain, right? Where it's not a knowledge of fact. It's a knowledge of, fact is the wrong word. It's not a knowledge of information. It's a knowledge of experience. And I think of it as like, well, they're just different ways of trying to explain the same thing, right? Because if we take the assumption that all humans are the same from a human perspective, then everyone's trying to figure out, well, all many traditions have tried to figure out exactly what's going on. And they've come to the same answer, but have used different ways of talking about it and describing it, and then created various institutions around it that look very different, but are aiming and perhaps describing exactly the same thing, right? It's the same essence in all religions, just by different name and different construct.
Yeah, I agree with you. So that brings us to, you know, the conspiracy theories, right? What's behind conspiracism, as we believe in, you know, research that how we look at it, is that there is, what is missing is an emotional or there's something that is giving meaning, that is giving, that is channeling the meaning to ego, to the consciousness. And that part is missing. And if something's missing, then you just have a theory, just you have a rationality. You have something like a formula that is repetitive, but it doesn't grow out from the fertile soil. It's not connected with the unconscious. So one can strongly believe in certain theory, but it is a representation of something that he's not aware of, that is hiding from himself, that is split off or unconscious. So it could be an anger, or could be a grief, could be a great loss, or could be something that he was indoctrinated to that is painful, but is lying in the dark side of his psyche. But he's compensating for loss of it by believing in something else. So I just to make more sense of it, so it's not too abstract. One has a theory that Donald Trump is the master who is going to bring the big storm, and he's going to repair everything, like everything that was lost and everything that was in sort of almost a religious way, right? Like he's the savior, he's going to repair the world, right? This is an ancient archetypal idea.
Yeah.
It's a myth that he's bringing. So person who believes that person doesn't realize that A, there is like archetypal contents that are influencing his mind. They are, you know, causing this mythical adherence, but also there is his own unresolved problems that he's like that are being projected onto Trump and on the whole idea of the QAnon and everything. Mm-hmm. One isn't, he's like a fighter, I'm gonna do it, but it should be his own internal struggle to be a conscious being, make Joe Schmo great again, right? Like repair your own life, work on your mental, physical health, on your family, on your friendships, on your everyday life. That's how you become religious. So that's the kind of the real way of becoming a happy person, versus thinking this guru will fix something for you.
And do people do that because they are afraid of confronting their own pain?
I would say the fear is definitely one of that. It's a process, right? Like in Jungian analysis, I mean, confronting unconscious or shadow, it's a painful process that comes with struggle, that comes with grief, it doesn't just come naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So if one gets closer to it, it becomes really scary. And all these defenses kicks in and start saying, okay, don't go this way. You are better off believing in the flat earth and, you know, just go online and just express anger and at others and so on, rather than figuring out what's going on within you.
Yeah. And psychic defenses are one of the most fascinating things for me as a sort of psychology student of how our mind knows how to protect us against pain to the best. Well, it tries, right? Just automatically. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to try to do it. It just happens. And there's all kinds of defenses that come up, but it's amazing that that exists, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that it exists seemingly counterproductively on the road to, individuation, where you sort of have to make, maybe it's not counterproductive. Maybe that's a misperception on my part, but you know, I suppose you could make the argument that, well, you actually, the going through those things and dealing and confronting the struggle and actually prevailing on the other side is the path that you need to take. It's mm-hmm. not to try and get rid of it, right? As mm-hmm. much as we try, because then there's no lesson learned in there. There's no growth, mm-hmm. right? As a, and that kind of feels like a shitty thing to have to be true, right? That you have to suffer and go through it in order to grow. But that does seem to be true. And it does seem to be present everywhere. That just mm-hmm. seems to be how the world works. That's yeah. even how evolution works, right? Even from a non-religious perspective, it's like you have environments and you have species in there, in these environments, and then all of a sudden something happens and it challenges them. And only the strongest, who are most well adapted, that's what strongest, I mean, in this context, survive, right? And the rest of them, they just die. And yeah. you know, that seems kind of shitty, but that's how nature works, right? And you see that in the wild too, like in Africa and stuff like that. I mean, it really brings you to the forefront of like what our mm-hmm. human nature is, you know, on a primal level, right? Of just like, we're not so different from mm-hmm. animals as much as we think we are. We are animals. We've just got a little bit of a higher consciousness.
Oh,
we've
yeah.
built civilization, but we're the same thing.
Yeah. Right?
It's very funny.
Few thousand years of growth of the gray matter in the brain, right? Rest underneath is
yeah.
the hundreds of millions. Yeah. You know, it's Jung thought about it, and he said the alchemy is opus contra naturam. So it's like to work against the nature. So when you think about it, it's a fine line between protection, that you're staying protected and cocoon, and integration of that, right? Like, so you have to be open enough to receive something positive that helps you grow and helps you survive, etc. But not too much, because then if you open that too much, that will destroy you, right? And then people who like kind of like, there are examples of it like from in the clinical practice I can talk about, you know, people actually going crazy. They couldn't handle the amount of unconscious. So there has to, the defenses are very important, and there yeah. has to be an optimal level. Let's say if you say, well, I don't like pain, right? Like it's hurting me so much. Why do I have a nervous system? You know, wouldn't it be so much nicer without the pain? Well, it wouldn't, right? Because you would hurt yourself pretty quickly. There are people who don't feel the pain and they come to, you know, there's a lot of the whole plethora of problems they run into. If you just don't have pain, you don't realize you don't have a foot anymore.
Yeah.
After hiking for a while, right?
You don't realize you're bleeding out.
Exactly.
So then all of a sudden you're just dead.
Yeah. So it's the same with the psychological defenses. We just have to kind of, okay, this is about it. And this is the optimal level of consciousness I need to live in with right now. And that's okay. And I'm in peace with that. So the enlightenment is not really like becoming out of the world, but coming back to the world with knowledge, what the world is and how dangerous can be.
Right. And using that to further your own and potentially other people's development, right? Or development or individuation. But so I actually had a question about, because we were talking about how people project, you know, their own sufferings and unconscious parts of themselves that have split off in order to attempt to deal with it, right, as a defense mechanism. And so you gave the example of Trump, where people idealize him as the savior, right, an archetypal idea of the one who will come and save humanity from whichever evil you think is existing, right? Not that there isn't evil, but just it depends on who you are, what you think the evils are. Now, do you think that, you know, like if we take that person who idealizes Trump that way, and it could be anyone, right? It doesn't have to be Trump, but we're just using this as an example. Do you think that do you think that they will find someone to fill that role for them? Like the actual person doesn't matter as much as the function that it serves for that person's individual psyche.
You mean like in real life, in their families and if it's around them?
Yeah, well, or it doesn't have to be people they know, but it's like people choose leaders of the world or, you know, living or dead. Well, I mean, living typically at this point in our conversation that, you know, if it weren't Trump, like someone else, they would find someone else to fill that role for them, right? Because they're struggling with that internally and they are trying to project it outwards.
Sure.
And so they need to find someone to fill that role.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. We see it, right? It's kind of like Jung would call a mass or herd mentality. Like people live in this kind of an unconscious mentality. So they're not individuated. They live in this like a belief that there is an outside force that will make them happy. Kind of conflictual relationship with the authorities or to their husbands, or they don't have their own sense of self, right? Like they go and vote for what their husband tell them to vote for, or what they're afraid of certain people because they have power over them, because they're not conscious of their own power. So they have a tendency to look for these gurus or look for the leaders until they wake up from that, right? Until they realize, okay, I have to find my own personal myth, personal religion, personal responsibility in my life. Immanuel Kant talked about it, you know, talk about the self imposed tutelage that leads to slavish attachment to authorities or leaders. And I think Trump came. It's the whole another topic, right? There was Obama who also, yes, we can, we bring the revolution, we bring kind of a new ways of approaching the world. And it became scary for a lot of people. And a lot of people realized they can't do it. They can do, yes, we can. Well, we have to vote for somebody who will do it for us or who's going to have those answers. And we have a lot of anger, and now he can legitimize this anger.
Right. And it's that relinquishment. No. Yeah. It's the relinquishment of personal responsibility, right, to an authority figure, because you, one, isn't sufficiently self-confident in your own ability to make decisions and take responsibility, which is part, it's a growth process, right? Like it's not something that's ever finished. I don't think it's not like you can say, oh, these people are, that's it. They've achieved it. Right, they're individuated. It's like no, it's a process that will go until you die, and then we'll see. How do you sort of reconcile that with belief in a good God, right? Because it sounds to me like it's a similar sort of process of projection of, you know, God will save me, God will do these things for me, or God is the reason why this and this happened, and with the underlying belief that God is good. Now, I'm not saying that these people are wrong or that you shouldn't believe these things. It's just a question of like, how is it different?
What the question of good God, that Jung actually had a whole conversation on this topic. It was a question of privatio boni, the privation of good, right? So the, for example, the kind of a Christian Augustinian idea, we can maybe from the Plato, is that the God is good and everything is good and omnipotent and perfect, and which is that that is not perfect or sinful comes from the lack of the goodness. It's like the lack of light in the darkness. So the Christian theorem says omne malum ab hominem omne bonum ab Deo. So that all good comes from the God, all the evil comes from the human. And Jung said, wait a minute, we have to look at the reality. He says the God is reality itself. And the reality is not all that good. I mean, there is a suffering and there is a pain. And we have to understand that God itself or herself or is not, it's beyond good and evil. It's immoral. And that all that morality that we projected, all the good and evil that we have about the God comes from our own discriminating ability or quality of our own consciousness. But that itself has is beyond, is the category that is beyond good and evil. So the really reconciliation comes through the consciousness. Once one knows the both sides of that reality, of this contradiction of opposites, this complexio oppositorum, the good comes as a result of it. It's not that this transcendent reality has the moral quality of it, if you know what I mean. So the Christian idea of the good God is a projection or maybe sort of a wishful thinking or inability to see and integrate the dark part of it, but it's a maneuver, it's a psychological maneuver. It doesn't say anything about the great reality of the universe. Now people have
right, which is morally neutral.
Yeah. Now people have those experiences, right? They have this profound experience of the accepting, loving, and the great universe. John Giannini, he said there is the feminine loving mother aspect that is underlying the reality of everything, right? The God is a feminine love. And there is something to that, to say that, right? This kind of an experience. From if you ask me, I would say that experience happens in the consciousness, and that happens as an experience of uniting those opposites within ourselves. That you know that you have to die and there is beauty to it. You know you have to suffer, but there is beauty to it, because if you try to deny that, you would never be happy. So you have this experience as a sort of a beautiful existence of what is, and the way it is, it's the only best way that is.
Right. Even if it's painful, on some level, you can appreciate the necessity of it. Right. And what's interesting, to go to one of your points there about the sort of morality being a human thing, right? And I think I saw a meme the other day. It was just two pictures, right? And it said that in a documentary about bears, a bear catching a fish is a great moment, right? In a documentary about fish, a bear catching a fish is a tragedy, right? And it was just a nice, simple, recreation of how context and meaning matters to what's happening, right? Because the situation is very simple factually. Bear catches fish, okay? You don't have to apply any sort of labels to it. But it depends from whose perspective you're looking at whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. It's a good thing for the bear. It gets food. It will survive and it will continue its life. It's a bad thing for the fish. It's the end of its life, right? It just got eaten by a bear. So is the situation good or bad, right? And on some level, if you can see all sides, it's neither, unless in specific reference points as the bear or the fish, where that's when you sort of see where it might be good or bad, And I think to sort of extrapolate that back to what we were talking about, it's like, well, we deem things good and bad in the world. But even then, it's like there's always gray area, right? There's very little thing. There's very few things that you can say with absolute moral certainty that 100% of the time this is the case, right? Because there's always possible scenarios where you are willing to bend that. You know, you just take something like murder, for example. It's easy enough to say it's never okay to murder another person. But really, that's not entirely true, because what happens if it's in self-defense? What happens if it's, well, you know, would you kill one person to save a million people? Maybe you wouldn't, but like, it's something to think about, right? Would you kill one person to save everyone, all humans on Earth? Or, you know, like, take it to the very extreme, or the Earth itself, right? So if you don't like humans, all animals in the world, like, would you be willing to kill one person to do that? And so it's like, it depends, right? It's like there's very little moral absolutism, as much as we like to think that there are, because it makes life easier for us to know how to guide our action, right? Mm. And so it's to bring us to the conspiracy conversation, is it's like, how do you navigate, where's the moral aspect of conspiracism?
Hmm. Yeah, you're bringing a good point. I mean, there is the highest, so-called highest value. It's an archetypal idea, right? Like the life, you can say life is the highest value. And wow, there's, you know, it's so strong, right? Like every parent or every human being considers themselves to be, you know, their own life to be highest value, or their own children. But if you don't take it with, as you said, if from this relative aspects, like who is asking, and looking at the from perspective of a population of the earth as whole, or when you are somebody who is deciding against or for abortions, right? They can be like, oh, the life is the highest value. So these two cells that are in the uterus are the highest value. There's already life, and therefore we can risk the life of the mother for that, you know, or the human rights, make your own decision and so on. So in what happens in conspiracy theory, I'm not sure if that's exactly what you're asking, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the conspiratorialists, they are unaware that they are deciding for these absolutes. They are on the side of absolutes. They said, this is the highest value. My idea is the truth. There is nothing that you cannot match it, because I'm already on the side of the good, and that is the only and right answer to the problem.
Mm-hmm. Or freedom.
Or right. Freedom, yeah. Anything. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to wear the mask because I have my freedom, right? You're trying to take over my freedom, which is the highest value in my mind.
So yeah, let alone being able to define it, you know? Yeah. It's like, well, if you live in society, you're not free. I mean, that's fine. But that's how it goes. And we negotiate exactly our levels of freedom within any given society. And I think that's a good thing to do. And I would obviously tend to err on the side of more freedom, as I think most people would, but not absolute freedom, because then you have anarchy, which is not good for anyone, except maybe a few sociopathic, violent individuals who will rule with an iron fist, right? But that's not good. At least I don't think so. Anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, So that's what you were asking. That's where you're aiming at the question. Okay, yeah. So the conspiracy theories are pretty much creating their own rigid myth about reality, or a certain event. But you know, it's 9/11, the moon landing, or now it become more political, right? I mean, you see a lot of that now in Russia versus NATO, you kind of thing in Europe. So they have their myth, but that myth, it's dark myth. It's a dark religious myth, because it doesn't allow for growth of a consciousness from pondering on those moral questions, from understanding responsibility, etc. Right? The healthy religion leads to those things, leads to suffering, leads to dilemmas, leads to questions that are like, how do you answer that? What's the right thing for me to do? I don't know. but they already know. And that's what fundamentalism, sectarianism, communism, etc., conspiratorialism, they already know. And they have answer for it, and they are the soldiers that want to fight for it. And they're unwavering. So you can discuss it with them, right? You can have a sort of a creative dialogue because they already have the answer.
So without sounding like they're a problem, because they're just people, but what do we do about this? I mean, is it a conversation issue? Is it an educational thing? Is it a, does it, how do we help people who get stuck on these trains to nowhere?
Okay, you probably think I'm biased, but I would apply kind of an analytical, the Jungian approach, right? Like use understanding and love and have a compassion with the person. Because what happens when you talk to somebody who's got these very strong positions, you're automatically going to get triggered, right? This is the unconscious connection. If somebody's yelling and screaming and putting a finger in your face, first reaction you have, you want to do the same thing, right? Like you go to this tribal response, right? Like you want to
defense, take,
you want to start fighting,
puff your chest out,
the other approach. But being able to look within and say, okay, I have to take a deep breath and I have to ask myself, what's behind it, right? Where is this coming from? See a bigger picture, and really trying to understand and have a questions for what's going on within myself, but what's going on with the other person, right? So it's really a loving approach, and it takes time and patience. And I guess it's so difficult for like anyone who is like not trained in it. And that's why Jung said psychology is one of the most important fields of our times. He said it the 20th century, but it goes forward, right? Because we have to, we learn so many things about computers and iPhones and who knows what. But we know so little, as Jung said, we are so pitifully unaware of ourselves. And that's where it starts. Like that's how we can change or improve the world.
For sure. I mean, even like, you know, I've always thought like no one teaches emotion regulation skills. Like such a fundamental skill in life is to be able to just self-regulate, right? And I view it like, well, it's because most people don't know how to do it. So how could they be teaching what they don't know how to do themselves? And it's fair enough. But, you know, we'll get there one step at a time. But I think you're right. And I like your approach because I think that most people typically will have the response of like, I'll convince them with facts, right? And it's like, well, that's not going to work, right?
Good luck.
You'll tire yourself out before they'll ever change their mind, right? If you don't hit them first or they don't hit you first. Like it's not the right approach. And you see so much of it, especially online, right? Where it's just these like information wars that are going on. And it doesn't resolve anything, right? These debates are not, you know, there's like two kinds of debates, I think. Well, maybe more, but as far as I can tell, there's two kinds of debates. There's a debate where both people are trying to figure out what exactly is going on, and they're open to suggestions and improvements on their own ideas. And then there's a debate of like, I'm right and I'm right. And now we're going to see who has the most power to prove their rightness, right? Which is more like an argument or a battle. And I think that the former kind of debating is actually fruitful and very important because, I mean, it's kind of like what we're doing now, except we're not on opposite sides of anything. We're just, we're figuring things out, right? We're talking. And in doing so, at least from my perspective, like I'm learning a whole lot, right? And I'm willing to change some things that I thought I knew because I'm getting new information in, right? As opposed to if we were like the abortion, it's a good one, right? It's like, it's clearly too very well solidified arguments on both sides, right? I mean, there's two sides and they both have factually very solid reason-based arguments. Like, okay, now what, right? You're just going to continue just throwing those arguments at each other? Like that's unhelpful because you're not going to convince anyone of anything, not doing it that way. And it's difficult in any case to convince someone of something, right? They have to come to that realization themselves more often than not. And it's not even that I think that people should be convinced of one way or another, right? Because that's a complicated question. Like, obviously I have my own views and so be it, and so does everyone else. But the negotiation of like societal norms and rules and laws, like, well, that's what this stuff is about, is it's about figuring out how to navigate these kinds of conversations, which I think are very difficult. And also, yeah, learning how to be triggered and be okay with it, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to have these kind of conversations, you have to be ready for it. Sorry, go ahead.
No. That's you're saying it very beautifully. Yeah, what comes to mind, right? Like, we have this message from Socrates and Jesus, like, who are like, you know, almost contemporaries, right? So you have somebody who tells you, I help you understand something by asking you questions. And by me asking the questions, you're going to figure it out yourself. I help you like a doula, you know, to bird this idea.
Yeah.
And
the Socratic method.
Yeah, the Socratic method. And I think Greeks were so good with that. And we sort of abandoned it. We just yelling at each other, saying, that's how it is. And, you know, you are the bad one. I'm the good one, right? It's never like, well, let me ask you a question. Why do you think that is? Like, what do you feel? What's going on? And et cetera, right?
And, yeah.
And then as Jesus's message, it was kind of like, love thy neighbor, right? Like, you just look at this person like you could be you, right? You're all one family, your own whole human race. You know, he may have a little different skin color than you, but you guys are all inhabiting this one small little tiny, you know, little piece of dust that's flying through the universe. You're all on it. And there is so far, there is no more of those as far as we know. You're going to destroy this one. Good. It's yourself, right? Like, that's the only world you have. You know, you have to remind yourself.
And what's scary is both of them were executed for those reasons, right? Socrates was killed because he poisoned the youth with ideas. And Jesus was killed for a similar reason, by society, even though they were both trying to help people in the right way, right? And I think that we do a version of that today with this sort of like cancel culture nonsense of like silencing voices that we disagree with, right? Which I strongly am against, because I think that it's good to have all voices out there, you know, and at least you know who's saying what. Like, I think it's worse if people are suppressed and have to do it in the shadows until they one day spring up with all this power and might, and all of a sudden it's like this, like a wave, like everyone's like, oh, where did it come from? Like, you can't do that, right? It's not the right way to approach it, in my opinion. But that's what people are doing, right? They're like, no, he's or she's saying the wrong thing. We must take down their voice, right? They shouldn't be allowed to say that, which is a crazy thing to mandate, I think, to be like, you're not allowed to say those things. It's like, I mean, I understand where the rationale is coming from, and there's some things people said that I don't like, but I think they should be allowed to say them, you know, within reason, I suppose.
Yeah, I agree. If there is a feeling present to it, like what's in the United States, there is this almost a fetish of the free speech, right? So many people think that they can say the most hateful, outrageous things just because they feel a certain way about someone, and they don't realize the power of the words, of power of their own hate is being put in the world. So they say, this is my highest value. I have the right of free speech, without really being able to consciously measure what I'm saying. This, who does it serve? What is it good for? You know, is it just my ego trying to say, I hate black people because they're black, or whatever?
Yeah, whatever nonsense people come up with.
Yeah,
it's interesting because, like, you know, it and it's a sort of common expression. They say people, it's like, it's freedom of speech, not freedom of consequence, right? And so you should be allowed to say what you want. That doesn't mean that people will be okay with it, or that it doesn't have consequences. And I think that's an important point in saying, like, well, yeah, I mean, technically you can have free speech, but if you say something to someone, well, they might really not like that and, you know, attack you or who knows what. And it's like, yeah, okay, fine. Accept that responsibility that your words have power, and then say what you're going to say. Yeah. Right. And be willing to take responsibility for the consequences instead of blaming whatever else on the consequences that come from that. But I do still think that you should be allowed to say whatever you want to say, legally speaking. Morally, it's a good question. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, we should have a discussion about it and so on. But yeah, prohibiting it doesn't solve anything.
No,
it's only like, it creates more conflict.
Yeah, it's just not a good way of dealing with it. Not to say that what people saying is excusable, right? It's not. But the way you go about making a change is not by repression or silence or suppression. It just doesn't work. Mm. They've tried it. I mean, people get killed for these kinds of things all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Communism is a great example of that. You don't agree with the party. Bye-bye. At best, you go to the gulag. At worst, you get executed, right? Like, I don't even know which is better or worse in those situations. Yeah. To be fair, gulag life sounds rough. But nevertheless, listen, this has been such a fun and interesting conversation. Please promote your book and your website and your stuff. Where can people find you? Where can they find more of you? It's been a real pleasure.
The pleasure was mine, Shane. It was a really great talk. You know, I wish we could continue and keep talking. It's just very stimulating and, you know, it really made my day.
So me too.
Maybe we'll meet again.
Yeah, I'd love to have you on again. Please.
Yeah, that would be, great.
Be fantastic.
And you are coming this way, Milwaukee or Chicago. Please let me know. We can sit down for a beer or coffee or whatever you drink and continue our discussion.
For sure. I'd love to. It's been so fun and I hope everyone else enjoyed it too. I'm sure they will because what better things to do on a Saturday morning?
Yeah, it's great.
Well, thanks. Everyone should buy your book. I will put links in the description for everyone to find it and your website and stuff like that. If you want to read more about it, it's a really dense but very good piece of work. So congratulations.
I appreciate it. I will actually email you a link to some of my articles at the Jungian Institute of Chicago that you can check.
Please do. Great. Well, thank you. And we'll speak soon.
Thank you.
Take care.